Welcome to the MoneyWise podcast. My name's Brianne Horn and I'm a reporter at MoneyWise magazine. Today we're going to be talking about three amazing stories, personal finance related. We're going to be covering ISA season and how to make the most of your allowance, how to make a will during the pandemic, and also the psychology behind overspending and how to get your finances back on track. So, Rachel, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about ISAs?
Yes, so I'm Rachel Rickard-Strauss. I am editor of MoneyWise. This is the time of year that we used to call ISA season. And I suppose the finance industry would get very excited about it. And savers would to a certain extent too, because it was the time of year when providers were vying for our business. So they were expecting that we're all trying to rush to fill our ISA allowances before the tax year ended. And so they would offer the best rates to try and lure us over to them instead of their competitors. And then just at the beginning of the next tax year, we'd see a similar thing where we'd see rates getting better and better, and the best buy tables were looking very impressive as providers did the same thing. This has not happened to the same extent for some time, but this year, I mean, it's just total tumbleweed. This is not to say that you can't get a good rate at all, and it's still worth shopping round, because if you haven't for a while, the chances are your cheeky provider will have put you on an absolutely unforgivable rate, starting with 0.0 and then some measly number after that percent. So it is still worth shopping round, but the rates that you can get, it's very hard now to beat inflation. So you can still get about 1.47% at the moment for a five-year fix. That's locking your money away for a long time, which in the current climate, I think lots of people are less inclined to do. For an easy access, really, you're looking at nothing much more above 0.8%. So then the next question is, well, is it worth it at all? It may not be that you'll get a very good rate now, but if you've banked your money in a tax-free wrapper, then later on you still have it there and you can switch it to a better deal. Or as and when you're ready to switch to a stocks and shares ISA, you'll already have the tax-free wrapper in place. And for some people, that can be a good option, starting to think about a stocks and shares ISA instead of a cash ISA.
And why are ISA rates so low at the moment? Like, what's happened?
Well, the big thunking issue is the base rate from the Bank of England. So that's the rate against which all banks will set their interest rates to savers and to borrowers. The base rate at the moment is 0.1% due to the coronavirus and the Bank of England working in conjunction with the Treasury to try and boost the economy as much as possible at the moment. So because the base rate is so low, then savings rates tend to roughly follow that as well. However, even before that, rates were very low and banks just aren't buying for our money in the same way.
And what do you foresee happening next for ISA rates? Do you think that they'll pick up as the year goes on? And do you think we'll see an improvement for the next ISA season?
I wish. I really miss those days when you used to be able to get, I mean, like even 3% on an ISA would be nice, but I don't imagine that that's coming back for a very long time. But it's still worth putting money away and doing so in a cash ISA rather than a conventional savings account. That can make sense. However, since they're unlikely to be going anywhere very soon, a stocks and shares ISA and thinking about trying to make more out of your money can be a good option. It's a nerve-wracking time to do so. Markets are very volatile. You can put money in a stocks and shares ISA and expect that it will possibly go down in the short term, even medium term, and have to hope that it goes up in the long term. But certainly over any sort of extended time period, if you have 5-10 years to put money away or even longer, you should expect to see a better return than the pitiful rates that you get at the moment on cash ISAs.
Brilliant, thank you. And Sam, on to you. Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself and how we can make a will during the pandemic?
Thank you, Brianne. So yes, I'm Sam Barker. I am the deputy editor of MoneyWise. And I've been looking into making a will, as you say, in the time of coronavirus. What are the difficulties that have sprung up? And what are some of the tricks to getting around those difficulties? So the outbreak of coronavirus has reminded many of us that making a will is a sensible thing to do, and that now is a good time to finally get around to it. Anyone who hasn't made one is not alone, because polls quite regularly show that 30 to 40% of the over 55s have no will, and that around two-thirds of UK adults as a whole also don't have a will. So this is one of the, I guess, life events that kind of can focus the mind slightly. So I started looking into, you know, how easy is it now with lockdown? How easy is it to actually get a will drawn up and over the line? And the answer is not very easy at all. So if the will is done online, as many are, many simple wills are, there'll be no problems at all until you get to the point where the will is signed by two witnesses, which is where the wheels start to come off slightly. So the reason is the law that governs wills has not changed very much since the, hasn't changed at all since the early 1800s, which was clearly pre-internet and clearly pre-coronavirus, pre-lockdown. So getting a will witnessed will still require the, I've never known actually how you pronounce this word, testator, the person drawing up the will, to have a physical document signed in the physical presence of two others. And so that is the case, even if the rest of the will is very simple and can be done online. And there are obvious health risks to that, which is problem number one, that getting a will witnessed the old-fashioned way is potentially, you know, breaking kind of government rules around social distancing and all the rest of it. So problem number two is actually finding witnesses, given that we're all on lockdown as much as possible. So many might say, well, aha, I'm isolating with, say, my spouse or my children, or I live with my sibling or a family member. Why can't I just get them to witness the will? And the answer is that anyone who is in your household is very likely to be, if you get on with them, it's very likely to be a beneficiary in the will. And beneficiaries cannot be witnesses, which is the 200-year-old legal law again. So in that scenario, the only way your spouse, child, sibling could witness your will would be if you had written them out of it entirely, which is obviously not going to endear you very much to them during the rest of lockdown, or probably the rest of your life. So what do you do? How do you get a will witnessed? One expert suggested to me, if you have neighbours, and this is quite convoluted, but it does make some sense. If you were to arrange to all go into your back gardens or to meet outside at the same point, wearing gloves and obviously keeping 2 metres apart, the kind of the testator will put down the will and stand back. The witnesses will then pick it up, sign it in the presence of the will owner, put it down, and then they will stand back. So that is one way of doing it. There are a few obvious problems with that. People who might not have neighbours, get on with their neighbours, might not have gardens, they might have reduced mobility. And of course, there is still a potential health risk to going down that route. And this is all just for simple wills that can be executed mostly online. So for some of the more complicated ones, a solicitor would need to be actively involved, and that profession is facing the same struggles the rest of us are, really, in terms of access to offices, wanting to work remotely, and frankly, you know, staff getting ill. So experts there think access to solicitors and delays to that process are also very likely. So I suppose the good news is that it is still possible, and you can still do it. And it is definitely a good idea to get one of these things in place. Obviously, there are laws that will kick in if you don't make a will that will determine where your estate goes and who, you know, there's kind of order of succession there. But it can be a messy process. It can be an easily disputed process. And it is a good thing to get that sorted out if you are at all able to.
Brilliant. And do you know if any short-term innovations might be made in this space to try and help people get their wills witnessed? It's been hundreds of years since these rules have been updated. So in light of everything that's happening, do you think the government will take action?
That is a fantastic question. So actually, the laws are so old that the Law Commission, so basically the answer to your question is possibly, the Law Commission did actually look at this 3 years ago and did suggest a few updates, but nothing has ended up happening. So you can get a sense of the kind of, there was sort of a huge friction that's been involved with this change. So more recently, over the last couple of weeks, two kind of will writing kind of bodies, and the law society have written to the Ministry of Justice saying, we think it's a great idea to move away from this old system and to have, you know, a system where you can sign witness a will online, or, you know, you can sign a physical piece of paper, but it can be witnessed through video link, kind of getting around some of the problems which cropped up because of coronavirus. Now, the problem with that is that, firstly, I don't know how much of a priority it would be for the Ministry of Justice to get onto it. And there is also another problem, which is that government, we're talking about a government IT project, which I think, you know, inevitably is likely to cost a lot of money and take a lot of time. Mm. So when I'm reminded of when the land registry moved from, and they brought in a project that said, no, look, you know, if you're a homeowner, you'll be able to sign your deeds to your property electronically rather than physically. So it's a very similar thing. And that process took years, even for deeds, which are often much simpler documents than wills and a lot more kind of cookie cutter in terms of how they look. So you could well argue that the land registry was in a bit less of a rush than we are now with things like this. I'm not hugely optimistic it would be a quick process. The Ministry of Justice also were quite reluctant to confirm very much to me or to give timescales, only to say that we are looking at it. You'd hope that maybe something like a video link system would be quite an easy fix that wouldn't require a lot of big spend or big IT projects. So the smart money would be on that probably. So I guess the answer is we'll see. I think they have to do something because we can't just keep waiting.
Well, that is really interesting. And I guess we'll keep an eye out and see what potentially could come in the future as this develops.
Brianne, you've written a feature for the latest issue, for the April issue of MoneyWise, about the psychology behind overspending and what causes us to do it and what we can do about it. Tell us a bit about it. What are the kind of spending triggers that are around us?
Yes, looking into why we are pushed to spend impulsively, I suppose, there are lots of different triggers out there. Walking into a shop, for example, a lot of money and investment goes into making sure that there are lots of subliminal triggers around you to make you part with your cash. And this could be the layout of the store, the lighting being used, the way promotional objects are put up. There's lots of visual triggers that might push you to spend in that respect. There are lots of triggers online. So, for example, you might get promotional emails that pop up in your inbox, or some apps actually have push notifications. So you're always notified if there's a sale going on, or they might just try and let you know about a new range of products that have been launched. And having all of this engagement and all of this attention being taken away and put into your device or phone can actually push you to spend a bit more than you actually intended to.
What can we do to change our spending habits?
There are lots of different ways you can try and change your spending habits. The first thing to do is probably try and work out what your triggers might be. So, for example, if you find that you tend to spend a lot when you've had a bad day or you feel a bit sad, when you have that emotion, instead of, say, reaching for your phone or laptop and purchasing something, go and do something else and distract yourself completely. Maybe try watching a new TV show or read a book, or get out and get a little bit of exercise. But putting a bit of distance between that initial emotion that you feel and the reaction of buying can help you not overspend and build that habit of trying to overspend to defeat that emotion. Another way that you can try and make sure that you don't make impulse purchases is to unsubscribe from your favorite shopping site. It's always great to know when there are lots of sales going on, but especially now that a lot of us are at home and don't have too much to do, the temptation to click on that sale email and go and spend some money could be a little bit more tempting. So unsubscribing from those promotions can help a lot. And another way, if you disable cookies, which are these little things that companies put on you when you're browsing the internet and track the different things that you do, they can use this information to target you with very, very, very specific campaigns and advertisements. So if, for example, you were looking at roller skates one day, and a couple of days later, you might be on Facebook or Instagram, and all of a sudden, there's an advert for roller skates, it's because they've used the cookies that you were that were following you around when you were looking at the roller skates initially, and they've served you exactly what you want, a pair of roller skates, and they've given you, you know, a few simple clicks, and all you have to do is enter your details and buy. So making sure that you clean those up can stop that targeting or reduce it whilst you're online as well.
Hey, Brianne, that's really interesting. And I actually wanted to ask about what could someone do if they thought that their mental health was kind of a psychological issue, which was actually affecting their finances and maybe perhaps causing them to overspend. What are their options? What are people's options in that situation to get some help with that?
That's a really good question. So there is a lot of research to suggest a strong link between people's attitudes towards money and the way that they spend and their mental health. One of the challenges that a lot of people have is actually associating the two, because often if you're finding yourself in a certain state of mental health, you might not actually realize that you're not where you're usually supposed to be. So some common symptoms that you might be having issues with your mental health include impulsivity, so doing things really reactively and not really thinking before you act, having reduced focus than you might normally, and also low motivation. And as we mentioned before, these states can often lead people to spend a bit more money or not pay enough attention to their finances as usual. So in terms of seeking help, there are lots of charities out there that can help you get in touch with somebody that can give you the resources that you need to help you manage your mental health and also point you in the right direction of the financial resources available to you as well. Once you have sort of spoken to somebody about the mental health issues you might be having, the next point of call is to get in touch with your bank and provider, because they actually have a lot of resources available for vulnerable customers. And once you sort of have a dialogue with them and explain what the situation is, so say for example you've ended up spending lots of money and you've built up a lot of problem debt across lots of credit cards, your provider might be able to help you work out a repayment plan so that you can actually tackle your debt bit by bit until you've paid it all off completely. But the sort of main thing is to make sure that you do get help and you don't suffer in silence.
Thanks so much for joining us for our first MoneyWise podcast. Please get in touch with us. We're all working from home. You'll all be at home as well. We'd love to hear from you. Get in touch at editor@moneywise.co.uk or on social media, on Twitter at MoneyWise Online and Facebook and Instagram as well. We hope that you're keeping well.